Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, pretty much just whenever I finish the book, I review it and stick the review up here on the podcast feed. So, not a lot of news at the moment, just sort of at home, very busy at the moment, writing my own novel for the National Novel Writing Month challenge, which is quite interesting, but I'm still reading other books as well at the same time. Not a lot of email feedback, I guess, since the last one. Nothing really to say there, but I use this service called Google Alerts, which what happens is Google obviously sends around all these little robots or whatever they call and to search the internet for mentions and things like that. And every time it finds a new page which mentions something, whatever search term you're looking for, it emails you, and because I entered in Science Fiction Book Review Podcast and SFBRP in there, I often get some cool links to people who mention this podcast on their blogs, and if it's mentioned in forums, sometimes it's get pulled up there, and I was recently just looking through some of the comments and the bad reviews that I've had for this podcast, especially the review that I did of Snow Crash. There's lots of geeks out there who really dislike my take on that book. They seem to have completely missed the points that I was actually making in the podcast. But then again, I feel okay sort of just completely disregarding the views of, people who are science fiction fans in the form of, like, Battlestar Galactica forums and things like that. And they think hero protagonist is the greatest protagonist in the world ever. And I'm like, okay, I can ignore that review, no problem at all. Anyway, so hopefully you're enjoying this. If you like this, actually, I just checked on iTunes a few minutes ago and somebody has put the very first iTunes review of this podcast up there as well. So, hey, maybe you want to do that? I don't care. Either way, so onto the book this time around, Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham, written in 1951. This book I bought secondhand. It cost me, I think, 50 cents or something from a secondhand shop in Bruges in Belgium. And it's this old English library book, which is quite funny. It's probably printed in the 1960s or something. All of the characters, you know, every time a character swears in the book, the swearing is sort of like censored a bit. It's replaced by a number of dashes. Now, I'm not sure if John Wyndham did this, you know, he self-censored, or if it was the library system that actually printed this book that edited it in that way, but it's quite funny because one of the former readers of this book, or maybe one of the former owners of the book, I don't know, they've sort of scribbled in pencil the swear words over the top of the censorship there to sort of see, you know, oh, I think he said this, and I tend to agree with that. Now, you may think, why is Luke mentioning this? Well, because it's actually a perfect setup for the world in the book. It's set in sort of like post-World War II, you know, Cold War world, but most of it's set in London and the south of England, and everything is very proper, because you imagine the sort of society at the time, you know, working classes are in their place and women are in their place and hard-working kind of intellectual men rule everything, and there's, you know, no swearing here, no swearing there. So I actually thought the printing of the book itself and the censorship in the book really sort of reflects the world that the book comes from. Because, you know, the era and sort of the outlook on life that's being portrayed there in the book is quite spot on for the times, I guess, like early 1950s. So the rest of the world, though, is, of course, gripped by, you know, the Cold War. Behind the Iron Curtain, Russia is developing new technologies and they're sort of putting weapons into space, which is quite accurate to what the world would be like after, you know, a few years after this book was written. This side of the Iron Curtain, America is pretty much following the same path, you know, putting weapons in space, developing new technologies. One of the biggest differences between the real world in the 1950s and 60s and the world of this book is, you know, except for the weapons in space, they're, you know, a bit far-fetched at the time. But there's these things called Triffids, and Triffids are kind of plants which pull up. They can sort of pull up three roots, and they walk on three roots. They've sort of got very, like, basic animal behaviours there, and they have this, like, swinging, swooshing stem on the top, which goes and stings people with a poisonous, like, barb at the end, or poisonous pad of poison at the end. And there's enough poison there to kill a human in mere seconds. And also, they're carnivorous, so they sort of, like, they can kill someone, and then they wait for the body to decompose a bit, and then they can rip bits of rotting flesh off them and eat them, or animals. If they kill a human, I guess they can do it to humans too. And finally, they can sort of hear things, like they've got a very basic sort of directional hearing. So if they hear something, they go towards it. But they can also rattle their branches to create noise. So as they're attracted to noise, lots of Triffids together form a swarm. And there's lots of Triffid farms all the way across England. The reason for this is that they're farmed for their, like, high-grade like vegetable oil content, because the oil content is much better than any oil that you get from sunflowers or whale oil. And it's just mentioned in the book. That's all the setup in the book. And yeah, the main character in the book, his name is Bill Mason. He's our like first person protagonist there. He's an expert on triffids, and he's convinced that they were, you know, that nobody actually really knows where they come from, but he's convinced that they were genetically engineered in Soviet Russia using the methods. I think it's quite funny in the book. It says it meant using the methods of Lysenko. And it's a great little like hint to the history of genetics and sort of the theories that were going around before DNA and stuff like that. Lysenko is completely discredited these days. But yeah, it was a good little mention. Actually, to be honest, all I know about Lysenko is from the Radio 4 show called In Our Time. It's pretty much one of the coolest, you know, I say coolest, it's not that cool at all. It's very, very uncool, but it's one of the greatest radio shows ever, I think. And you should listen to it because it really does make you a better person. And they did an episode on Lysenko, which was very interesting for me. Anyway, so the story starts with Bill Mason, and he is in hospital because he's been blinded temporarily. He was working, you know, with triffids, and some poison got into his eyes. He was wearing protection, but it managed to get through his mask and into his eyes. And so he has his head wrapped in bandages, and he's laying there in hospital. And while he is there, I mean, this happens just before the book, like the night before the narrative of the book really starts, the Earth swings through this patch of strange meteorites, and everyone goes outside to watch all the lights coming down, and there's these sort of green blobs here and different colour lights falling out of the sky. And yeah, so the book starts with a line, which is a great line. I'll actually just read it here. I made a note of this because it's a classic science fiction introduction. When a day that you happen to know is Wednesday starts off sounding like a Sunday, you know. So it's like that kind of thing. So it sounds, it's Wednesday, but it sounds like a Sunday. Everything is very quiet. And of course, something is very, very wrong with the world. There's been this like mysterious flash in the sky the previous night, and it was so bright and it went on so long that anyone outside or anyone near a window or anyone in some kind of open space where light can get in from the sky has been blinded. And that is, of course, the largest, like the huge majority of people are now blind. So Bill Mason, our first person narrator, he doesn't work this out straight away because he like removes his bandages and he starts exploring his room because nobody's coming in to look after him in the hospital. And then he explores like his floor in the hospital, and then he explores the hospital itself, and then he explores the street outside, and then eventually he starts exploring London itself, the city of London where he is in hospital at the time. And I really like this. It's a really cool introduction. It's like this, okay, you wake up, nothing's happening, everything's wrong, and you don't actually know what's happened, you don't know what's going on. And he finds out about it bit by bit, and you sort of explore the world in taking larger and larger steps. Literally, it starts out describing him in his bed, and then goes to the room, then goes to the floor, then goes to the hospital, then goes to London, you know, the street outside, and then to London. And I really love, I mean, it's a classic introduction to, like, a post-apocalyptic society, or, you know, a great introduction to the apocalypse itself. Because everyone is now out on the street, you know, all the blind people are wandering around, they're looking for help, they're wanting help, they're looking for food, and others realizing what's happened, they're not looking for help, they decide on suicide. And there's quite a lot of suicide at the beginning of the book, and yeah, it's really quite unpleasant, and our hero finds it so unpleasant, he pretty much spends the first, like, day he is outside of the hospital, like the first day after the blinding incident, pretty much getting drunk. But he keeps exploring, and he finds this woman called Josella. She's obviously the love interest, and they're pretty much the only two sighted people that they find while walking around. There's a few others, but they seem quite dangerous at the time, you know. And after a few days, they decide that they're going to... Well, actually, quite quickly, they decide to make plans, and they set themselves aside a few days to get together all the equipment they need, and then go into the country and set up like a hideaway there and wait. Or maybe just try and survive, or pretty much they want to get out of the city because it's too dangerous in the city, and of course people are dying and nobody's clearing up the bodies. They need to get away from any kind of germs or any kind of infections that's going to spread around London. But they quickly, actually, within a few days, they meet up with a larger group who are also looking to survive, but not only to survive, they actually want to start a whole new society. Which is, I'll talk about that in a bit later, I guess. Next up, they have, they're attacked by some blind people who are looking for some help. You know, the blind people want some help, and they're led by a living man. You know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, you know. So there's this one sighted person leading a whole like army of blind people. And of course, Bill and his love interest, Gisella, they get separated. Now, the rest of the book pretty much revolves around Bill once again trying to find Gisella. And of course, you go out of London, you visit lots of different places in London, meet lots of interesting characters, all that kind of stuff. Of course, most of the people, I'm not going to go into the story that much more because, yeah, then it's only a short book. There's not a lot I can say about the plot without giving it away too much. I mean, it's, you know, it's a very sort of logical step-by-step exploration of what's going to happen after an apocalypse like this. Like I say, he meets interesting characters, but all of these characters are very much just like, they're sort of like representatives of like different ways of putting together a society, sort of focusing on whatever core principle they think is the most important. And I think this is one of the most important, or one of the biggest themes of the book, to sort of compare and contrast between different approaches to sort of organizing society, different politics and stuff. For example, the first group that they meet up with, like you said, they're just about like, okay, anyone who's blind, forget about them. We can't help this helpless situation in London. And so they do all they can to save sighted people. And they do all they can to sort of make as many babies as possible to sort of repopulate England with sighted people, with, you know, sort of overtones of fascism there as well. You know, sighted people, superior, blind, are just relegated to sort of second-class citizens. They're only good for, you know, the women are good for breeding stock, but the men, well, just leave the men, they're useless for everything. And the leaders have sort of some kind of supreme authority, and anyone who disagrees with their views, nothing bad happens to them, they're just sort of asked to leave the society there. But then again, maybe in a post-apocalyptic society, that might be the best way to go. I don't know about that. Then another person called Croker, he is someone who wants to stay in London and do everything that he can to help the blind people. It's, of course, to other people and to the main character, Bill Mason. It's like a hopeless mission. But Croker's respect for life trumps that. You know, the blind people should be treated equally and helped equally as well as sighted people, you know, sort of like a very sort of communal thing, like a communism, like everyone has to help everyone out and, you know, try and keep everyone equal. A little nod to that there as well. Another group is all about keeping traditional Christian values. Funnily enough, this group doesn't actually attract anyone except women who want to be sort of kept in their very sort of, not so much easy life, but like a very traditional life. And no sighted men join this group at all, except for a vicar. And they don't last too long. And yet another group, or another character, that they meet represents like a pure dictatorship run in a very militaristic style. You know, uses force whenever it needs to get what it wants. Doesn't matter who gets in their way. They'll just shoot anyone in their way to get their access to food or whatever they need and things like that. And finally, there are many small groups which don't seem to want any help from anyone. They're just very isolationist. They just go, okay, you get on with what you want. You do that, don't worry. We'll just sort of go here. We'll just be us four people trying to farm and trying to survive and trying to live off the land somehow and avoid blind people and avoid anyone else. So, yeah, you've got like this all this setup, all of these trying to survive in the world of a blind. And it is very much a commentary on sort of different political systems, I guess, at the time, and sort of comments on what it might lead to and the good points and the bad points. Of course, it's talking about a post-apocalyptic society, but it's very much commenting about the world in the sort of 1950s, I guess, early 1950s. And I guess in a normal world, all the people, all these little groups would probably survive okay, because it's all I've got to do is sort of keep out the way of blind people, like rampaging blind people, but they don't need to keep out the way of them for very long because they'll all die of disease and stuff. Then you've just got to avoid the disease, like stay out of cities for about a year, and then you can rebuild. Doesn't seem too much of a problem. Except, of course, that other factor called the Triffids. Boom, boom, boom. These, of course, quickly break free of their farms and spread chaos. Bill Mason, though, he actually worked with them. So at the very start of the novel, he was like, okay, the Triffids are going to be the biggest challenge for the survivors. And everyone else is going, Triffids? What are you talking about? Nobody cares about Triffids. Turns out he was, of course, right. So Bill and the other survivors encounter them. At the start of the book, you know, just a few of them. But as the book progresses, they just become more and more and more, like they pop up more and more throughout the book. And at the end of the book, everyone's existence is defined by their position and how well they are coping with the Triffids. Of course, Bill is an expert, and he, you know, he treats them just like, in the end, just as a pest, as an annoyance. He's comfortable working with them. His main problems seem to be like, okay, the roads are falling to bits and the infrastructure's all collapsing. Others, of course, don't seem to stand up quite so well against the Triffids. So, yeah, another big theme of the book I guess this is that it's like the hubris of man. I actually just wrote this down here. It's like, because man seems to play God with nature, and it's actually talked a little bit about here in the book. It creates dangerous things, deadly things, and they just sort of leave them lying about themselves, just going, oh, of course everything will be right, everything will be in control, but then it takes one disaster and all these dangerous things get out of control and suddenly they're deadly to everyone and nobody noticed the danger before there was a disaster. And I guess this theme resonates today just as much as it did back then, but maybe I guess it's probably more noticeable to readers back in the day. Of course, you know, they're actually creating it. You know, we've got used to living in a nuclear world now, but back then it was like a big danger. So, yeah, there are more themes, of course. Might as well get to them now while I'm talking about different themes. For example, it is noticed, of course, that some things happen in the book which can't be natural, and they're sort of probably the result of some space-based weapons. And this is, again, another comment on the danger of doomsday weapons. And finally, I guess the characters in the book, they insist, a lot of them insist that any day now, Americans will be coming along to help out Britain. Britain's all blind and all overrun by Triffids, but the Americans, they've probably got it sorted out. They're going to turn up and, you know, and help us out. And of course, they don't turn up at all throughout the book. And I guess this book, written in 1951, is like a clear message to Britain and a clear message to parts of Europe. It's like, we can't rely on the Americans to bail us out of yet another disaster, out of yet another conflict. The Triffid swarm, for me, it sort of represents the swarming like mass of troops from the Soviet Union. I live in Berlin at the moment, and because reading parts of this book remind me of the siege mentality that was here in like 1948 to 1949 and the Berlin airlift, all that story. If you don't know that story, it's a great little piece of history, probably not taught as much as it should be, or not taught that much. It was like the opening sort of salvo in the Cold War, when Berlin was completely surrounded for the first time and nobody was allowed in or out by, of course, the Soviet troops. Or West Berlin, that was, of course. But yeah, it sort of really brings that mindset, that kind of siege mentality throughout the book, that the mindless sort of like inhuman enemy is outside, and us British people on the inside. And are the Americans going to help us out? Well, they have helped us out in the past, in the Berlin airlift, World War II, and all these kind of things, but they might not help us out in the future. Next up, look at my notes here. Story, I guess I've covered that. The major thing, no, I guess the story, yeah, it's a really like clips along. It's like the book is under 200 pages, and I actually wish more books were written to that length these days, because, you know, it really does, it clips along, you finish it and you go, ah, that's it, everything I need to know there. It does slow down in a couple of places, but it's a real page turner. You just like, you start reading, you could probably read it all in an afternoon, no problem at all, and you want to read it that quickly too. The writing style, I actually really enjoy it. It's a very sort of literary style, you know. John Wyndham obviously has a fantastic command of the English language, and while, you know, sometimes it's a little bit sort of like out there, you know, some characters, they start quoting poetry and other books to each other and things like that. I don't obviously get all these references. Some of them I do, which is quite fun. But it's very British. That's the thing about this book. It's like, I do this. Like, I couldn't actually help but like put on funny voices in my head when I was reading it, because all of them are so British. Like, the way it's written is so British, it hurts. Yeah, like, just as an example here, just open the book one second here. Okay, because, you know, I'm looking at like this operation number 3, I told her, is quite definitely dinner, you know. And I was just thinking in my head, oh, everyone will be speaking, you know, in a perfect British accent. Over here we have this, over here we, you know. And it's just because my classic British accent there is like dropping all over the place, but, you know, it's sort of like that kind of like, okay, 1950s radio play kind of voice in my head as I was reading it. I actually quite enjoyed it. Of course, it feels a bit dated now, but at the time, I guess that's what people were used to, that kind of thing. Also, finally, at the end of the book, final conflict for our protagonist, he doesn't resolve it by shooting everyone. I'm not going to give away what he does do, but it's actually quite clever, and he uses sort of like the themes of the book in his, you know, in his getting out of this final situation. There isn't a lot of science fiction technology in the book, I guess. The only thing out of the ordinary here is, I guess, the anti-Triffid weapons and the other things like that. The rest of the time, it's pretty much city people trying to get to grips with country life, you know, so they're more rediscovering technology than inventing new technology and things. Things that I didn't like of the book seemed a bit sexist, I guess. Maybe it's the attitudes of the book of the time, but it seemed a bit too Victorian rather than sort of post-World War II. It seemed a bit too early. But then I think that's probably just the attitudes of the characters in the book, because some of them are very much like anti-feminism and some of them are very much like, yeah, females have to really pull themselves up. But there's this sort of like a lot of the relationships is like, okay, I'm a man, I go out and work, you're a woman, you stay in home and clean and look after people, and I go out and do the full work here. So it did feel a little bit sexist, but again, not a big, you know, condemnation of the book there or anything like that. There is this relationship between Bill and Joe Seller, which I don't really think has a lot of time to develop. They only seem to spend a few days together, and in that time, they're sort of meant to fall in love so deeply that when they're separated, Bill will go from risk his life and limb time and time again to find her and be reunited. And I didn't really quite believe that as the motivation. I mean, it was okay, but I they didn't have a lot of time to set up that relationship to make me believe it a lot. Maybe it's because Bill, as our very, very British narrator, he's a bit uncomfortable talking about his, like, the intimate details of the relationship. For example, at one point, they're talking about they'd sort of Bill and Josella get together and they're having a dancing, like, they dance at night. And then, the narrative cuts off and then it picks up again in the morning. And it doesn't blatantly say that they had sex. So I can't say, oh, they didn't really have a deep relationship, because maybe it was a bit of a deeper relationship if they did have sex. But again, it's sort of, like, hinted at. And, yeah. Final thing, I guess, about the book that I didn't really find that compelling was, of course, the Triffids and the blinding flash in the sky. They seem at first a bit too coincidental, like it's like two disasters that link together, but not really linked together, a bit too coincidental. But of course, the Triffid disaster wouldn't happen. You know, it wouldn't be a disaster if it wasn't the blindness in everyone in the land, in the whole of England. But then, of course, the blindness wouldn't have been such a big disaster without the Triffids. Of course, you have to have them two together. And they are sort of tied together, like, a little bit in the book. But, again, it's not entirely satisfactory, the way that they're tied together there. So, but not big criticisms of the book, only sort of very mild stuff. Apart from that, I think I really enjoyed this book. I don't find a lot of things wrong with it at all. Short episode. Don't really know what else to say about the book. Oh, yeah, of course, I made a note of this. This is the first time I've read this book since watching the film 28 Days Later. It came out, I think, 2001, 2002. And while watching that film, I only watched it for the first time last year, but I was watching it and I was thinking, wait a second, this is a little bit like the Day of the Triffids. And then something else happened. I was like, no, this is really like the Day of the Triffids. And then something else happened. I'm like, no, this is really like the Day of the Triffids. And of course, you can really see the influence of this book on the Day of the Triffids on the film 28 Days Later. It's clear time and time again, things happen, characters pop up, you know, even the same journey that they make and even the conflict that they have at the end is pretty much against the same type of people wanting to do the same kind of things. It's very strange in that way, which is a real pity, because I'd love to see the Day of the Triffids actually made into a film. Actually, it probably has been made into a film, but I'd want to see it made into a modern film. Let me have a look here. Day of the Triffids. Sorry, just looking online here. Day of the Triffids. Yes, from 1962. There you go. And you can see it on Google Video. Oh, there you go. Yeah, 131-minute video, the original Day of the Triffids film from 1962. There it is online.
In nature's scheme of things, there are certain plants which are carnivorous, or eating plants. The Venus flytrap is one of the best known of these plants. A fly, drawn to the plant by a sweet syrup, brushes against trigger bristles. Just how these plants digest their prey has yet to be explained. There is much still to learn about these fascinating eating plants. This is a newcomer, Triffidus celestis, brought to Earth on the meteorites during the Day of the Triffids.
Anyway, sorry, I shouldn't just sit here reading Wikipedia and the IMDb. So anyway, yes, what was I trying to say? I've completely lost my place. Oh, yeah, if this was made into a film now, everyone will just look at it and say, it's a rip-off of 28 Days Later. Where, in fact, of course, 28 Days Later was, of course, this book was the main inspiration, or one of the main inspirations for 28 Days Later. Sorry, I shouldn't go off my notes quite as far as that. Got a bit distracted there. Finally, I guess, as I said last week, this is one of my most read science fiction books ever, and obviously influenced what I like about science fiction, because I read it at such a young age, I guess. It's sort of like, the thing I love about science fiction is you set up a fictional world, throw in a complication, analyse the results, and then use those results to comment on the real world, and this book does it perfectly. Sets up a fictional world, you know, throws in a meteor strike with a big flash in the sky, see how it all plays out, comment on the Cold War and the world situation at the time. That I really enjoy it. And also, because I read this so early, and I grew up in a house without a television in my house when I was much younger. Like, so when I was playing with my brother out in the garden and things, like Triffids and Flashes in the Sky were some of the big things that, you know, our big, like, favourite subjects that we would play on and role play on that you do when you're a kid. It wasn't stuff that was on television. It was books, like science fiction books and things like that from back in the day. And to be honest, I don't think I remember a time when I didn't know what a Triffid was, because even before I read the book, it was like a favourite topic of, like, conversation for our family sitting around the dinner table, you know, even before I read the book, there it was. And finally, something that came back to my mind when I was reading this book is, if you don't read the comic, the webcomic XKCD, you should do, because it's fantastic. But if you do know it, there's this comic about, like, someone who analyzes every environment that they go into, every room that they go into, for its suitability for being a hiding place against Velociraptor attack. I'll put a link of it up on the wiki page for this article. Well, anyway, what you should do is take that comic and replace the word Velociraptor with Triffid, and that was pretty much describes my childhood. Every time I go into a room, I'd go, oh, you know, would this be a good place for against Triffid attack? Every place you'd go, you go, oh, if a Triffid attacks now, what would I do? Would I run there? Would I climb up there? What would I do? And that's how I thought. Of course, until Jurassic Park, when the baddie of choice was Velociraptors for me from then on. And Triffids, but also Velociraptors. Anyway, I'm telling you all of this because my high score might be slightly influenced by my nostalgia about this book. You know, because all in all, I really did enjoy it. It still stands up as a fantastic, even though it's a classic. And if you haven't read it, you really should have read it. So I'm going to give this book 4.5 stars out of 5. There you go. It's a bit of a shorter episode. But then again, it is quite a short book. And yeah, hope you enjoyed my review. Again, if you haven't read it, do read it, because it won't take you long. And it is a British science fiction classic. Might not be so well known in America, but certainly in Britain, it's a classic. The next book I'm going to read is Paul of Dune by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson. Yes, it's another Dune book. And you may be thinking, what the hell? Luke said he was never going to touch one of these, like, non-canon Dune books. Well, there's a bit of a story behind that, and I'll explain it in full in the next episode. But yes, I'm going to do Paul of Dune, the new book from Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson. After that, I might read The Kraken Wakes or The Chrysalids by John Wyndham, or I might go for one of the other 20 books that I have sitting there beside my bed, because I keep picking up new books and then finding other things to read and things like that. So anyway, if you've got some more book suggestions that you want me to try out, if you've got any views about my review here, if you don't like The Day of the Triffids, or you've got any comments about anything else like that, you can either email me, or you can go to the SFBRP wiki and add comments there, or suggest books there on the wiki page. It's all self-explanatory, and you know what to do. So otherwise, catch you later.